various religious topics and doctrines, and also political, social, and cultural issues. Following this, we'll feature more of our radio productions. Stay tuned. The next is another segment of our radio productions.
On September 22, 1980, when the Islamic Revolution of the Iranian people was not yet 2 years old, Saddam attacked Iran with the green light from the U.S. The former Iraqi dictator has signed a peace agreement with Mohammad Reza Pahlavi 5 years earlier, which had ended his border disputes with Iran. But just a few days before issuing the order to attack, much like the U.S. president who tore up the JCPOA agreement, he appeared openly and confidently on television and declared all his commitments with Iran null and void. Forty-five years later, with a 12-day imposed war, all these memories were revived for Iranians. This time, with America's green light, Benjamin Netanyahu, instead of Saddam, attacked Iran at a moment when indirect negotiations between Tehran and Washington were underway to supposedly resolve Iran's nuclear file peacefully. Now the entire world was waiting to see whether, just as Iranians under the guidance of their leader in the 8-year war with Saddam managed to force the enemy into accepting a ceasefire and defeat, in the second imposed war, the Israeli regime and its supporters would also be compelled to retreat or not. Contrary to its aspirations, the Israeli regime is not a major naval or land power, and all of its military capability lies in air superiority, reliant on the support of the United States and NATO. It was this capability that Israel emerged victorious in the major wars of 1967 and 1973. Yet, war planners knew that with traditional methods, an attack on Iran would not be possible. Iran shares no land border with this regime, and the distance to its sensitive and strategic points lies beyond the flight range of Israeli warplanes without aerial refueling. For this reason, airstrikes of the kind carried out in Gaza, Lebanon, and Syria are beyond the capacity of the Israeli Air Force. Thus, in the recent imposed war, the Israeli regime once again resorted to its old and once successful tactic of blitzkrieg, this time adapted to the conditions of the modern era and drawing on experiences from Syria and the war in Ukraine. The term Blitzkrieg itself entered the military vocabulary back during the Second World War, at the time when the Nazis decided to settle the fate of Europe. Hitler had many options, one of which was Blitzkrieg at the start of his invasion of France. At that time, France was considered one of the largest armies in the world, and in a conventional war, could have stopped the Nazi war machine. But that did not happen. The Germans, not aiming merely to defeat France, but to collapse its army, government, and national morale, had launched a surprise attack that later came to be known as Blitzkrieg. In this way, Paris accepted unconditional defeat within 12 days and remained under the boots of the Nazi soldiers until the end of the war. The Zionist regime, using the name Blitzkrieg method, managed to win the battlefield in just 6 days in 1967. For this reason, in attacking Iran with the approval, coordination, and support of the White House, it chose the same method. But carrying out this operation, in addition to military and security preparations, also required other preliminaries similar to what Rafael Grossi carried out. According to the plan devised by America and Israel, Grossi was supposed to frighten Western public opinion with reports so that everything would be prepared for major war against Iran. That is exactly what happened. Rafael Grossi betraying the legitimate and legal rights of the Iranian people while accusing the Islamic Republic of nuclear evasion and concealment provided the groundwork and pretext for the aggression of the Israeli regime and the U.S. against Iran. The regime's next plot was Donald Trump's negotiation game. In this design, the White House, knowing that in the midst of negotiations, no one expects a full-scale battle, try to lower the level of Iranian readiness to confront the aggression of the Israeli regime. Interestingly, to make the deception even greater, June 15th, just 2 days after Israel's attack, was set as a date for a new round of indirect negotiations between Iran and the United States, mediated by Oman.
پیشنهادات و راهکارها ارائه بدن و بعد دور بعدی مذاکرات تنظیم بشه و
What's happening now to Syria or what's happened to Syria over the past year and a half is what the Israelis would like to do to Iran. They want to fracture their neighbors, break them apart if possible. So that's how you deal with Egypt and Jordan. And with countries like Syria, countries like Lebanon, countries like Iran, countries like Iraq, the basic goal there is to wreck those countries, to break them apart, to make them dysfunctional. And that's the second goal. That's the regime change goal when you dig down deep.
The Israeli regime's assessment was that, given Iran's chronic economic problems and social divisions, after a lightning military strike, spontaneous protest cells would emerge, and what happened in Syria would be repeated in Iran as well. Thus, it was that June 13th marked the beginning of a difficult time for Iranians. With the multi-layer hacking of the integrated air defense system and targeting of warning radars, the first challenge to the security of Iran's skies emerged. Within a short time, the path was opened for heavy air-launched projectiles to enter Iran's airspace so that, in the most severe manner possible, both the country's high-level military command structure would be destroyed through the assassination of commanders, and Iran's valuable assets in the nuclear and defense industries would be eliminated.
37
The commanders whom the Israeli regime assassinated at dawn on June 13th were the very ones who were supposed to direct the war. Commander Bagheri, Commander Rashid, Commander Salami, and Commander Hajizadeh. The scientists who were assassinated were Dr. Abbasi, Dr. Tehranchi, Dr. Ferri, Dr. Zulfaghari, and Dr. Manoucher, all distinguished professors at Iran's top universities in nuclear fields. The assassination of nuclear scientists, like that of military commanders, was repeated several more times until the end of the war, and in total, during the 12-day imposed war, the Israeli regime robbed Iran's scientific community of 13 prominent nuclear professors. In the course of these assassinations of commanders and scientists, many innocent citizens living in their neighborhoods, as well as members of their families, were also martyred. According to the planners of this attack, with the assassination of high-ranking generals, the situation in Iran would become so chaotic that hired groups and counter-revolutionaries could seize control of parts of Tehran, such as Mehrabad Airport and its surrounding areas, from the police and security forces. This was deemed to cause the conditions through street chaos. Special forces would be airlifted into Iran, pushing the structure of Iran's government to the brink of collapse within a matter of days. Although the blows delivered at dawn on June 13th would have been enough to bring about the collapse of the governments of many powerful countries in the world, this did not happen in Iran. In the very first hours after the attack, the leader of the revolution, through a message, illuminated the path of resistance for the Iranian nation. Despite security threats, he maintained this line of communication with the people and officials throughout the 12 days of war, so that while directly managing the battle, the necessary measures could be taken based on the realities of the field. The presence of the commander-in-chief during the 12-day war once again proved his role in restoring psychological calm to society and preserving the cohesion and organization of the armed forces in defending the country. The peak of this unique role was in appointing senior military commanders as replacements for the martyrs who had been assassinated by the Israeli regime. On the afternoon of the first day of the war, the leader of the Islamic Revolution once again addressed the people in a televised message. In the past, it had been proven many times that Iran, through its missile industry, possesses both the capability and the will to punish its enemies, especially the Israeli regime. For this reason, Iran's missile response was the most predictable action of the Islamic Republic, and naturally, Israel had devised what it thought were countermeasures for it. According to their plan, in the very first moments of June 13th, the commanders and missile bases of the IRGC were supposed to come under fire. With extensive propaganda and the wide circulation of images showing the destruction of missile launchers on June 13th, many were led to believe that Iran no longer had the ability to respond with missiles. Launch of dozens of older generation IRGC drones before noon that same day could also have made these illusions seem real. But shortly afterward, following the televised message of the leader of the revolution to the people, the first wave of Iranian missile launches began, plunging the West into an intelligence shock. The name of this operation had already been determined: True Promise 3. In line with operations True Promise 1 and 2, the IRGC in its first missile response did exactly what the regime had anticipated, using a large number of missiles so that the Israelis would feel assured that Iran's missile response pattern had not changed. The Israeli army assumed that by Iran's numerous launches, the locations of its missile systems would be exposed and subsequently under aerial strikes, another portion of the Islamic Republic's missile capability could be destroyed.
Country in the world that believes that when they just go out and start bombing civilians, that that's called self-defense. It's absurd. So Iran didn't waste any time. They have retaliated within about less than 24 hours, and they've hit Israel and Tel Aviv and other sites throughout Israel. The Israeli government's going to great lengths to cover that up and pretend, oh, nothing happened here.
Israel suffered massive losses, many direct hits in Haifa, in Beersheba, in Tel Aviv, the Iron Dome, and the other parts of the system, because that's just one component of Israel's air defense system, failed on multiple occasions. Iran has missiles that can penetrate Israel's air defenses.
A large number of missiles, drones, and ballistic and cruise missiles launched in Iran's first response was observed. The armed forces of the Islamic Republic updated their information on the regime's defensive layers. After that, contrary to the enemy's expectations, the number of missiles decreased. This was the second stage of deceiving the Israeli army, because the other side assumed that the missile stockpiles of the Islamic Republic of Iran had been severely reduced. Now, it was time to carry out the next stage of Iran's new missile tactics. At this stage, while launching small waves of missiles at different times, the number of operations increased. Gradually, unlike the hours of night and darkness, launches were carried out during the day and under the bright sky, the very sky over which the Zionists and America claim to have dominance.
How badly was the Israeli defense industry in Israel damaged by the retaliation from the Iranian missiles? Do we know?
No, we don't have any details. There's no question that a number of sites were hit. Air bases were hit, research institutions were hit. They ran out of defensive, or they were running out of defensive missiles, as we know. So damage was done, and of course damage was done to all sorts of buildings, both military buildings and civilian buildings inside of Tel Aviv. And then in Haifa, they hit the port. They did enormous damage to the one of the two oil refineries that the Israelis have. So they did, the Iranians did an enormous amount of damage inside of Israel. But
Israel thought, A, that this war would be short and quick. They thought they had the decapitation strike in place. Shock and awe would collapse the regime. That didn't work. They were hoping that their ballistic missile defense shield, together with American assistance, would be able to prevent significant damage being done to Israel. They're wrong.
The variety of launch systems used each time surprised the other side even more than before. The launches were a combination of old and new generation missiles, the product of years of tireless effort by martyrs such as Tehrani Mogaddam and Haji Zadeh. This abundant, large-scale, and diverse legacy was employed each time with a different arrangement and type, resulting in the defensive systems of the regime being worn down after repeated engagements. The simultaneous use of old and new missiles significantly increased the chances of hitting targets. As a result, the armed forces were able to successfully strike vital targets such as the Weizmann Research Center, intelligence and security facilities, the Rafael military complex, the Haifa refinery, airports and military bases, strategic industrial installations, and dozens of other targets in 22 waves of missile attacks.
Yeah, mashallah. How you say it?
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Supplication is the wealth of the believer and the bridge by which one achieves proximity to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the Exalted.
A path to salvation, a way to connect the two worlds. On the program, Bridge.
You are listening to the program Bridge on Iran Radio with Sheikh Mahdi.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحیم الحمد و الثناء لله رب العالمین و الصلاة و السلام على اشرف الانبیاء و المرسلین حبیب قلوبنا و طبیب نفوسنا ابو القاسم المصطفی محمد و علی آل بیت الطیبین الطاهرین. Respected brothers and sisters, it's an honor and a blessing for me to be spending the next few minutes on one of the greatest du'as and supplications of Sahifa al-Sajjadiyya, the great legacy of Imam Zain al-Abidin. We've started the 20th du'a, which is titled وَكَانَ مِن دُعَائِهِ عَلَيْهِ السَّلَامِ فِي مَكَارِمِ الْأَخْلَاقِ وَمَرْضِيِ الْأَفْعَالِ. And noble moral traits and acts pleasing to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The supplication of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam on that. And the very beginning portion of the du'a, the very beginning phrase, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam presents Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala with four requests. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Begins the du'a by blessing Muhammad and his household. So we do the same. وَبَلِّغْ بِإِمَانِ أَكْمَلَ الْإِمَانِ. Cause my faith to reach the most perfect faith. Something that we talked about in the previous session in detail. What I wanted to mention in this regard is that the righteous actions is mentioned after faith in many verses in the Holy Quran, such as the very famous one that perhaps many of you or all of you recited on a daily basis in your salat. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم والعصر إن الإنسان لفي خسر إلا الذين آمنوا وعملوا الصالحات. Right? By the time, or by the element of the time, verily man is in loss, right? Except those who believe, right? Faith comes first, and perform righteous deeds. That's why Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, in the very, very first line of this dua, says, وَبَلِّغْ بِإِيمَانِ أَكْمَلَ الْإِيمَانِ. Make my iman and faith to become the most complete. And then by that, and if that becomes the case, the next level is the excellency in certainty. وَجْعَلْ يَقِينِ أَفْضَلَ الْيَقِينِ. Let's take a quick break. We'll be back shortly.
A path to salvation. A way to connect the two worlds.
The bridge between Allah and His creation.
A bridge that is meant to take us to Allah, to take us to His proximity. A bridge that is in the form of dua and supplication.
In this program, we offer commentary on the du'as of As-Sahifat As-Sajjadiyya of Imam Sajjad alayhi salatu wasalam.
The famous book of litanies, the Psalms of Islam.
Bridge.
Rabbana, Rabbana,
Rabbana. Respected brothers and sisters, the many similar verses, all of which indicate that the righteous action were part of faith a subsequent or a subcategory or a result and fruit and product of faith, right? It would not be necessarily to mention it. And it's certain that the lack of or the lack or deficiency of action is evidence of the lack of weakness or the lack of existence of faith, right? If someone's actions are not matching with what they claim to be believing in, then you should doubt their claim, right? For example, if I say I believe in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and I believe that He's just and He sees everything we do, good or bad, then I do continue to oppress my beloved family, my surrounding people in any way that I have the ability to do so. It means that I do not really have faith in a God that sees everything, good or bad, right? That means that belief is just a claim. It's not belief. It's not settled and synced into our hearts. The second part of this portion, this phrase, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam asks Allah the Almighty the request, which presents him with the request for completing or reaching the most excellent and the best stage of yaqeen, certainty, right? This request, in fact, is the plea for the best stage of, for the highest level of yaqeen. Some people have assumed that certainty is a definitive belief in which the possibility of believing its opposite is entirely non-existent. For example, I see the sun in the sky and I'm walking and there's daylight. I see it by my own eyes. No matter how many times, how many people would insist, hey, we are spending time in the middle of the night, I won't take their words. Why? Because I'm seeing the sun by my own eyes and I believe that I'm breathing in a daytime, right? I am in a daytime and whatever other people say will have no zero effect on me. But imagine if the case was the other way. Therefore, it seemingly makes no sense to consider certainty as having different stages or different beliefs or different ideas. No, once you reach the level of certainty, then things become completely clear for you, completely clear, to the extent that the opposite idea or the opposite so-called belief is considered non-existent. Let's take another break. Inshallah, we'll be back shortly.
You are listening to the program Bridge on Iran Radio.
Our respected brothers and sisters, we've been saying that certainty is the fruit, is the next level, or is the advanced stage of having complete faith. When you have complete faith, then you will reach a new realm called the realm of certainty, the realm of the most complete faith. And Imam Sajjad alayhi salam says, do not only make me enter that realm, but also elevate me to have the most excellent, the best, afdal al-yaqeen, the highest level of certainty. The truth is that ilm al-yaqeen, the knowledge of certainty, is only one stage of certainty. Higher than that is ayn al-yaqeen, right? The most tangible level of certainty. It's there for you. The first one, ilm al-yaqeen, you have the knowledge of certainty. You know it's there, right? You know Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is there. Ayn al-Yaqeen is that you consider Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala by the full capacity of your heart that He's there. You do not have the knowledge. You feel it. It's most tangible, right? And the highest, is there a higher level than that? Yes, the highest level of conviction and certainty is haqq al-yaqeen, the truth of certainty. You completely fade in the fact that, for example, Allah is there. You never forget it. It's always there for you, which is considered, again, the highest level and highest rank of conviction. Inshallah, in the next session, I'll make an example of differentiating between the three. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You just listened to the program Bridge on Iran Radio with Sheikh Mahdi.
هرگز نگیرد تا ابد آقا کسی جای تو را هرگز مخواد از کف دهم عشق و تولای تو را
across the seven skies, see a pure heart never lies. The words you learn will never earn. It's time to think and wonder why. Stars above will always be a shining guide for us to see. And when I doubt, I'll have no doubt, but still I wonder why. Digging through our pages past, wondering how the truth will last. God's in control is what I found. I think I'll try this time around. And no one really feels the path I seek. And no one's gonna care as much as
have to have a very fair assessment of this academic and intellectual icon of early Islam.
His impact is more pronounced in jurisprudence that he formalized.
And tens of thousands of statements and teachings have reached us from Al-Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam.
This is Dialogue, an introduction to the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today, we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the history of Islam, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. The sixth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam, was an incredibly prominent character in the history of the Muslims. He benefited humankind with his highly scientific achievements, many of which had never been seen before by humanity. Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam's instructions in the acts of worship and transactions and his contribution in the field of legislation were amazing achievements that had not occurred before amongst the Muslim masses. And his eminence also had a positive and active share in the establishment of human culture and civilization. The sixth divinely appointed Imam, the son of Imam Baqir alayhi salam, an individual who was divinely appointed by the Almighty Allah, was known to have improved the general public lives of the people and the Muslims, and he was an individual, a divinely appointed Imam, a man from the household of the Holy Prophet, who enhanced human thoughts and discovered many of the secrets of this universe. Welcome back, dear listeners. This is IRIB English Radio, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. So there are some beautiful statements and really interesting statements that have been made by Mansur Dawaniqi, who was the second Abbasid ruler. Now, what's really interesting is that many times in the conversations or the statements between Imam Sadiq alayhi salam and Mansur Dawaniqi, we find that this Abbasid ruler, he praised the sixth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam. Now, what's really intriguing about this is that Mansur Dawaniqi was one of the most violent enemies of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. And of course, it is at the hands of Mansur Dawaniqi that the sixth divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam, was martyred. He was poisoned and then he was martyred. But we find that no matter how great the enmity and hatred and animosity of the enemies of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam becomes or reaches, that they are still forced to admit the excellencies of the divinely appointed Imams alayhim as-salam. And we find this with all of the divinely appointed Imams alayhim as-salam, that the rulers who wanted to kill and murder these Imams alayhim as-salam, these rulers and these murderers really of the infallible and immaculate divinely appointed Imams alayhim as-salam, they always praised them in one place or the other. Now, sometimes it was sincere praise because they had no option, because truth is truth, and, you know, eventually you cannot hide the truth.
But many times it was just for show, you know, to make the people think that, you know, they have nothing to do with the murder of the imams. So anyways, in one instance, Mansur Dawaniqi, he says to Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, he says, "We are still benefiting from your ocean and visiting you," meaning ocean of, I guess, wisdom and knowledge. And then he says, "It is you who restore light to the blind, and it is you who lights up the gloom. Therefore, we are circumambulating, we are doing the tawaf of your holy places and your endless oceans." In another place, Mansur Dawaniqi says that Ja'far ibn Muhammad was one of those about whom Allah the Almighty has said, "Then we have given the book for inheritance to such of our servants as we have chosen." And this is a verse of the Holy Quran in chapter 35, verse number 32. In another place, Mansur Dawaniqi says, "Imam Sadiq alayhi salam was one of those whom Allah chose and who hurried towards performing good deeds." And the last thing, when Mansur Dawaniqi was talking to somebody else about the excellencies of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, Mansur said to him, "What really suffocates me is that Ja'far ibn Muhammad is the most knowledgeable in his time. Even the enemies of the Ahlul Bayt were forced to admit and prove the excellencies of the infallible and immaculate Imams alayhim salam." This is Dialogue Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. IRIB English Radio, our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir. And now let's listen to Sayyid Muhammad Jawad Al-Ghazwini.
There was a man who had passed away. Very, very decent man in one of the communities overseas. During his fatha, his funeral, a person came, nobody knew him. And he was crying like he had lost his own father. The people, the family were puzzled. "Why are you crying like that? What do you know about him? We don't even know you. We've never seen you." He said, "I have a story with this deceased, this marhum. I have a story with him. One day he was in the masjid praying, and as he was praying, I noticed that he had a very expensive ring. Maybe because he had done wudu and he was waiting for hands to dry, or for whatever reason, he put his ring on the carpet as he was praying." He says, that person says, that "I have a habit of stealing valuable items. And I'm very good at it. I'm skilled at it." You know, some people, when they pick your pocket, you don't even notice it. He was one of those people. He says, "I go and stealthily, discreetly, without him noticing, I take the ring." And then he's like, I'm on the side. I'm making myself like I'm some wali min awliya Allah, praying my salah. He says, when he finished his salah, the guy was smart. When he finished his salah, he called me. He's like, "Come." He's like, "Oh no, I got caught." He noticed. He's like, "I tried to deny it, apologize. I was thinking of a strategy, an exit strategy." He told me, "Look, I know you took my ring. And maybe you're in need. I don't want the ring back. I don't want to take you to the police. But here's my business card." I told him, "Your business card? Why are you giving me your business card?" He says, "Because the next thing you're going to do, you're going to take this ring to a jewelry shop to sell it and make some good money. The jewelry shop owner, when he looks at the ring, he will know you stole it. Because this ring doesn't match how you look." I'm just telling you. It doesn't match your appearance. And he's going to call the cops on you. If he doubts you, here's my business card. Tell them I got this ring from this person. The man says, "I went to the jewelry shop to sell it. The minute he looked at it, he told me, 'Look, I know this ring is not yours.'" And he wanted to call the cops on me. I took out the business card. He called the man. He verified it with him. He said, I'm crying like someone who lost his father. In my life, I haven't seen someone like him. I don't know him. He doesn't know me. But that moment changed my life. After that day, I repented to Allah. I changed my entire path. One small incident like that can change an entire human being. This is the inspiration of Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam. And this is a beautiful lesson, beautiful teaching that we learned from him.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the program, Dialogue. For more information, visit our website at iranradio.ir. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio.
Hello, I'm Kabitav Waid. In today's program, we have the honor and pleasure of having with us Dr. Manoucher Motaki. If you're not familiar with Dr. Motaki, he was the former foreign minister of Iran during the time that Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was in office. Now, he's very familiar with Iranian politics. He's been a fixture in it for quite some time. And one of the aspects that he's very familiar with is Iran's nuclear file, not only during the time when he was in office, but also given the recent developments that have happened in that file, of which we will discuss with him at length in this edition of the program. Dr. Motaki, welcome to Unscripted.
Pleasure being with you.
Thank you. Let's start off with, I don't know if you want to call it a celebration, but it's an end of a decade of what was called the JCPOA. Give us your thoughts as to what you think it represented, and now that it's over, where you see this file going, and what positives and negatives were entailed during the time it was in existence.
The JCPOA is yet another case initiated from the goodwill of Iranian officials. Negotiations lasted for 2 years, and now 10 years have passed since the agreement was reached. According to UN Security Council Resolution 2231, sanctions against Iran were supposed to be suspended after these 10 years. However, in practice, they not only have remained in place, but the United States' extraterritorial sanctions have even imposed harsher restrictions on Iran than those that existed before the deal. Iran's optimistic approach was short-lived, as it was met with a disproportionate response from the other parties. Despite Iran's full compliance with its obligations, the other sides, particularly the United States and the European Troika, refused to uphold theirs. The U.S. withdrew from the deal midway, and the European parties not only neglected their commitments to lift sanctions, but even went further by imposing new ones. For us, the JCPOA's most important promise was the lifting of sanctions after 10 years. While we do not celebrate this milestone, we honor the perseverance and resilience of the Iranian people in withstanding a decade of unjust sanctions. Last month marked the end of the JCPOA's 10-year term. I believe that the unlawful and unfair decision by the three European countries to trigger the snapback mechanism, this time turned against them. For the first time in the history of the UN Security Council, a division emerged among its permanent members, those who, despite occasional differences, had generally maintained a unified stance on Iran's nuclear program. We saw China and Russia, together with Iran, condemning the European Troika's action as illegal and illegitimate. They formally expressed their objections in letters to the UN Secretary General and the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency. The Russian representative, who held the Security Council presidency at the time, articulated this position explicitly. So, from our perspective, the JCPOA has effectively come to an end. Now, what I propose is that, beyond our officials' acknowledgement of the deal's expiry, we should formally announce our withdrawal from it, as the agreement has brought us no tangible benefits. As we say in Persian, it is time to pull out this bad tooth that has brought us nothing but pain and loss. Such a step would also prevent the Europeans from exploiting the JCPOA as a means to exert further pressure on us. Therefore, I believe Iran should officially withdraw from the JCPOA, and after that, our peaceful nuclear activities, like those of any other normal country, will continue solely in accordance with safeguard obligations and under IAEA supervision.
Well, we have the Iranian Foreign Minister, Abbas Araghchi, who, in an interview very recently, again state that Iran will not negotiate its missile program. He said no sane person would accept its disarmament. He also said we cannot stop uranium enrichment, and also adding what cannot be gained through war cannot be gained through politics. When he says that, and when you state that we should enter a new framework of negotiations, how will this particular two non-negotiables be negotiated?
The Americans not only failed in the JCPOA, but also in their overall approach to negotiations. During Trump's first term, Washington called for talks with Iran while simultaneously imposing maximum pressure and harsh sanctions, a request that Iran firmly rejected. Even Trump's letter to the leader of the Islamic Revolution, delivered by the Japanese Prime Minister, was dismissed. Our leader made it clear that while he respects the Japanese Prime Minister as a friend, he does not accept Trump's message. In his second term, Trump again called for negotiations, but we had no reason to trust him, given America's record of broken promises. The United States has repeatedly tried to deceive its counterparts in negotiations. A lesson Iran has learned over the past 46 years, from the 1981 Algiers Accords to this day. We agreed to indirect talks with the U.S., but they turned out to be nothing but a cover for Israel's preparations to attack Iran. The U.S. itself admitted that it was aware of Israel's planned aggression. These negotiations were therefore a deception. Why should we negotiate with those whose only goal is to mislead us, especially when they push the talks into a dead end before they even begin? They claim to seek dialogue only to deny Iran its right to enrich uranium, a demand that is unlawful, illegitimate, and contrary to international law. As a member of the international community and a signatory to the NPT, Iran has the inherent right to enrichment. Who are they to tell us otherwise? No one has the authority to dictate that Iran cannot exercise this right. They have also claimed that Iran should be deprived of defensive capabilities. Today, any person, even a child, only by looking at what has occurred between Iran and Israel over the past 6 months, can tell that disarming Iran would simply give Israel a free hand to carry out more attacks. Would the United States ever agree to negotiate over its own defense capabilities? Iran holds a vital geopolitical and geostrategic position. This region is the heart of the world, the center of global energy and economy. In such a sensitive environment, should a country like Iran not be able to defend itself? Naturally, the United States has no right to interfere in this matter. So when the U.S. raises issues such as Iran's enrichment and missile programs, its true objective is to sabotage the negotiations. The leader of the Islamic Revolution emphasized the same point in his speech last month. Therefore, Iran will not engage in talks with the United States unless Washington first recognizes Iran's right to enrichment and self-defense. Only after such acknowledgement would Iran consider discussing other matters.
So if you were to take a comparative analysis during the time that you were foreign minister, in which you had a voice for the negotiations, given what we're looking at now, do you see there being any type of breakthrough?
Let me share my personal point of view. As a member of parliament, I see no necessity at this time to negotiate with the United States. There is nothing left that requires such negotiations. We believe that the Americans have no right to interfere in our internal affairs. Therefore, I see little chance that there will be any negotiations with the United States in the foreseeable future.
Let's go back to the question I want to ask is about Russia's role and even China's role in terms of Iran when it comes to its nuclear file, and now that we have experienced the 12-day aggression from the Israeli regime against Iran, the 12-day war, as some call it. We are seeing much more active support, at least it appears that way, from Russia, also from China. Do you think that they are doing what they can to support Iran as much as is possible? Or do you see any restraints there? Do you see any impediment or any restrictions on their side to assist Iran, or can they do more?
Russia and China fully understand Iran's strategic significance. 40 years ago, when I headed the East Asia Department at the Foreign Ministry, the Chinese Foreign Minister, Mr. Wu Jian, paid a visit to Iran. It was the first such visit by a Chinese Foreign Minister. After his meeting with Iranian officials, as he prepared to depart, he told us that a strong Iran is in China's interest. Today, Russia wholeheartedly shares the same perspective, that an independent and powerful Iran serves the interests of its friends, both regionally and globally. Our relations with China and Russia have had ups and downs, but today they rest on mutual understanding, shared interests, and a common perception of current realities. These are strong foundations for a strategic partnership. Russia once avoided describing its ties with Iran as a strategic, but now it announces it openly. China, likewise, considers Iran a strategic partner. While other energy suppliers to China may face disruptions under external pressure, Beijing understands that its energy cooperation with Iran will remain in place and benefit both nations. So we regard China and Russia as our natural and reliable partners. Regarding Iran's nuclear program, we have previously raised our concerns with both countries. During my time as foreign minister, I addressed this directly with Mr. Sergei Lavrov in a two-hour discussion. I explained that although Russia and China may refrain from proposing new resolutions against Iran at the UN Security Council, and often seek to moderate Western proposed drafts, our objection lies in the fact that they still vote in favor of those drafts. We had a very candid and constructive exchange on this matter with both the Russians and the